Part 2, The Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 6. It was always the same thing. Fritz Haber got excited and anxious and eager and intensely productive, and then his stomach tied in knots and he had trouble sleeping. He grew short-tempered. He called it nerves. About once a year, the anxiety increased to a point where he could no longer focus effectively on science and had to take time off, spend a few weeks at a spa or a sanatorium, take a health cure. Afterward, he would return, revived, ready to throw himself back into his research. This time, he knew it was going to be bad. It had been building for months and came to a head at the 1907 annual meeting of the Bunsen Society for Applied Physical Chemistry in Hanover, Germany. Here, in front of an audience of Haber's peers, before the men he wanted most to impress, he was publicly insulted. To make it worse, the man attacking him was one of Germany's greatest researchers. The insult came from Walther Nernst, a chemist about Haber's age who seemed to have achieved everything Haber had not. Nernst was a full professor of physical chemistry in the epicenter of German academic culture, the University of Berlin. Haber did research at a solid but unspectacular technical university in the south of Germany. Nernst was being spoken of as a future Nobelist for coming up with the third law of thermodynamics. Haber had not produced anything close to a great theory. Nernst was the protege and heir of apparent to Wilhelm Ostwald, Germany's reigning genius of physical chemistry. Haber had twice been turned down for a job in Ostwald's lab. Nernst was a Gentile. Haber was a Jew, a fact that might have played a role in Ostwald's rejection. Ostwald wrote that he turned Haber down because he seemed a bit too ambitious, a bit too pushy, code words, perhaps, for being a bit too Jewish. As if all that were not enough, Nernst had sold an idea for an electric light bulb to a German firm for 1,000,000 marks. He was a very rich man. Haber was not. The dispute seemed a minor matter, a question of a few data points related to the formation of ammonia, but it had festered and grown. Ammonia, a simple compound formed when a nitrogen atom combines with 3 hydrogen atoms, releases heat when it is formed. Nernst's laboratory had calculated precisely how much energy was involved in the reaction, but his numbers differed from some Haber had published back in 1905. Haber thought his numbers were right, Nernst thought his were, and neither man would back down. Haber had done his original ammonia work for an Austrian company that wanted to find a profitable way to take nitrogen in the air, which cost nothing, and use it to make ammonia, which could be sold. Haber was hired as a consultant to explore the possibilities. He worked for several months on the project, which turned out to be quite difficult because the nitrogen in the air exists in a twinned form that chemists call N2. Two nitrogen atoms fused tightly together into a single molecule. The two atoms are so stable when linked to each other, so strongly tied, that they are almost impossible to separate. In this atmospheric form, called dinitrogen, or, in chemical shorthand, N2, they refuse all other relationships. The nitrogen bound in this form is inert, dead, unavailable to living things. Everyone breathes in and breathes out lungfuls of N2 all day long, and nothing happens. Early chemists, struck by the fact that candle flames went out and animals died when placed in a jar of nitrogen gas, gave it an early, now extinct name, azote, without life. All the action in the air comes from another atomic twin, O2, oxygen, a molecule eager to break up and enter into all kinds of reactions. Atmospheric oxygen makes things rust, makes things burn, and keeps you alive. Atmospheric nitrogen, it seemed, did nothing. To turn N2 into ammonia or anything else, its two nitrogen atoms first had to be torn apart. Once that was done, the freed nitrogen atoms became exquisitely reactive, eager to bind to a number of other atoms to make an array of compounds, from fertilizers and explosives to the proteins and nucleic acids necessary to life. The problem Haber faced in his research for the Austrians was tearing apart the N2, a process easier to imagine than accomplish. Chemical bonds come in a range of strengths. A typical chemical bond holding two atoms together, what chemists call a covalent bond, is strong. Sometimes atoms will be joined by two of these bonds at the same time, a double bond that is much stronger. N2 is held together with a triple bond, the strongest chemical bond in nature. Breaking it and freeing the individual nitrogen atoms requires enormous amounts of energy, heat on the order of 1,000 degrees Celsius, intense enough to melt copper. The only thing in nature hot enough to break apart undying nitrogen is a bolt of lightning. Ammonia, by comparison, is fragile, which Haber found put him into a sort of scientific catch-22 while he was working for the Austrians. To tear apart the N2 and release the single nitrogen atoms needed to make ammonia, the temperatures had to be so high that the system destroyed any ammonia that formed. Adding to his difficulty was the fact that the formation of ammonia, combining one of those free nitrogen atoms with three hydrogen atoms, gave off quite a bit of heat of its own. It was almost impossible to save any ammonia before it burned up. Haber ran his experiments using special equipment made of platinum to withstand the heat. Reaction chambers made of iron would have glowed cherry red at the required temperatures. Succeeded in breaking apart the N2 and tried to devise ways to quickly cool any ammonia that formed, but nothing worked well enough. He could never secure more than a trace of ammonia. A commercial process was an impossibility. He gave the company the bad news, wrote up his results, and published some of his data in 1905. Nernst read Haber's report and thought that something was wrong. According to Nernst's theories, Haber should have found even less ammonia than he did. To check, Nernst set an assistant to work on the problem. The young man found, not surprisingly, that his boss, Nernst, was right. Nernst wrote Haber in the fall of 1906 that he had new, correct ammonia data that he planned to present at the coming Springs Bunsen meeting. Haber's stomach started to clench. His reputation had been built on careful experimental work. To have Nernst question it publicly was unbearable. Haber immediately started rechecking his data. One thing that Nernst had done differently was to use an air compressor to put the ammonia reaction under increased pressure, a trick for pushing it toward greater ammonia production. Haber added higher pressure to his experimental setup. A young chemist, adept with machinery, Robert Le Rossignol, was brought on board to help figure out the apparatus. With Le Rossignol's help, Haber ran a new series of ammonia tests, heating the gases in quartz tubes to handle the increased pressure, and seeing what happened when different mixes of temperature and pressure were used. The new results were closer to Nernst's, but still significantly different. Haber kept getting more ammonia than Nernst thought he should. The yield was not high enough to interest any businesses, but the added pressure helped to squeeze out more ammonia, as did the use of different catalysts, substances that push forward chemical reactions without themselves being used up. By running the hot nitrogen and hydrogen gases over the right catalyst and putting it all under pressure. Haber could lower the temperature of the reaction, which helped reduce the destruction of the ammonia that formed and boosted his yields. He unveiled his new numbers at the May 1907 Bunsen Society meeting. Nernst presented his own lower numbers. Their discussion became heated. Nernst called Haber's numbers highly erroneous and noted dryly what a pity it was that Haber's numbers were not accurate, because if they were, they might hint at the possibility of a commercial way to make ammonia. He said, "I would like to suggest that Professor Haber now employ a method that is certain to produce truly precise values." Those were fighting words. Haber, insulted, returned to his school and threw himself into even more ammonia research. Soon after, Haber's wife reported that her husband was suffering, his skin breaking out, and his stomach in knots. Fritz Haber had been born into a thriving Jewish community in the town of Breslau, then located in the eastern part of Germany. Now it is Wrocław, Poland. His mother died a week after giving birth. Haber was raised by his father, a successful dye and paint manufacturer who was rarely idle, rarely around the house, and, it seems, rarely satisfied with the son. Fritz grew into an impatient, insecure young man, devoted to proving himself and eager to gain acceptance and achieve high position. All of that, he felt, was within his grasp as a German Jew. Many Jews in Germany in the late 19th century felt fortunate. Many doors were open to them that were firmly shut in other nations. They were allowed to attend and even to teach at the great German universities. They could start successful businesses, as Haber's father had done, and they could practice professions like law, journalism, medicine, and the sciences. In Germany, they excelled in all of these areas. It was estimated, for instance, that up to 20% of Germany's scientists were Jewish. It was true that Jews were still barred from some careers. They could not join the German officers' corps or serve in the highest levels of the civil service. And there certainly was an undercurrent of anti-Semitism expressed openly at times. Although rarely savagely, there were no pogroms in Germany. It was certainly true that poor Germans began to envy the success of Jews. Anti-Semitism was also especially deep, it seemed, among the old aristocracy of Germany, the Prussian nobles who controlled the military. It was even said that Germany's king, Kaiser Wilhelm II, a man whose policy seemed even-handed towards Jews, was a closet anti-Semite. Every German Jew, no matter how successful, had felt it. "For every German Jew," wrote Walter Rathenau, later Germany's foreign minister, "there is a painful moment that he remembers his entire life, the moment when he is first made fully conscious that he was born a second-class citizen. No ability and no achievement can free him from this." Still, there was a sense of hope among German Jews, a sense of pride, a sense that perhaps the great wheel of history was turning, that along with all the late 19th century excitement about workers' rights and women's rights, there might also be a time when Jews would be integrated fully into German society. As the historian Amos Elon wrote, "In most other European countries, prejudice and discrimination seemed equally or more prevalent. With all its shortcomings, Germany stood out as a country where acculturation, social integration, and day-to-day tolerance seemed to have as good a chance as anywhere else in Western Europe. Many German Jews thought it was better even than France, where the Dreyfus affair had shown just how deep anti-Jewish feelings ran." The important thing for Haber was not how Jewish he was, but how German. This was true of many German Jews, intent on leaving behind the old baggage of religious prejudice and concentrating on the birth of a new era. Intermarriage between German Jews and Christians became increasingly common during Haber's lifetime, rising from 8% of Jewish marriages in 1901 to almost 30% in 1915. It seemed at the turn of the century that the last bits of prejudice might wither away, and that Haber's dream of modern German Jews becoming simply modern Germans would become a reality. He, like many German Jews of the era, became a German superpatriot, a vocal supporter of the nation's ambitions, and a believer in Germany's shining future. As a child, he attended a progressive school, a simultaneous school. It was called that mixed Jewish, Catholic, and Protestant students. It was a step towards assimilation, but it was not a complete success. He endured his share of taunts and teasing and emerged from school with an unexplained scar on his face. It looked something like a dueling scar, ironically a mark of honor among Prussian military men. But his dream of assimilation, his belief in Germany, was still untarnished. At the same time, Haber's interest in chemistry blossomed, starting with semi-secret chemical experiments in his room, where he mixed heated and watched things react until his father, unhappy with the smells coming from under his door, forbade it. When it came to pick a profession, Haber proved a restless student, spending a few years there, focusing mostly on chemistry, but also writing a bit of poetry, working for his father for a time, and serving a required 1-year stint in the military. He was allowed to join, but not to serve as an officer. He learned how to carry himself with military bearing. He still planned to be a chemist, but could not decide what kind he wanted to be. It was as if he were too smart, too curious. 4 years, he flitted from school to school in Berlin, Heidelberg, and Zurich. From mentor to mentor, from electrochemistry to physical chemistry to organic chemistry, constantly looking for acceptance and respect, constantly experiencing what he felt were rebuffs. He finally earned his doctorate in 1891 for studies related to the dye industry. He never seemed satisfied, was always critical of himself. "The thesis is miserable," he wrote afterward. 1.5 years of new substances prepared like a baker's bread rolls. Lots of results that I cannot even publish because I fear that a competent chemist will find them and prove to me that the camel is missing its humps. He earned money after graduation doing lab work in an alcohol distillery, a cellulose factory, an ammonia soda factory, and a molasses plant. They all bored him. He researched furiously, but without focus. He achieved little. The failure of this phase of Haber's career, one of his closest friends later wrote, was total and protracted. So he did what he thought was necessary. At age 24, he converted to Christianity. Haber had grown up in a Jewish household that was anything but Orthodox. His sister remembered that Christmas trees and gifts were more important than Yom Kippur, so it seemed like a relatively small matter. He, like many forward-thinking German Jews, saw religion as more formality than conviction, a baptismal certificate. The German Jewish poet and essayist Heinrich Heine wrote, was the entrance ticket to European culture. Conversion was certainly not uncommon among German Jews of the day. Between 1890 and 1910, about 10,000 German Jews converted out of a population of somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000, and the numbers kept increasing. It is worth noting that a number of leading German Jewish scientists of the same generation, however, never converted. James Franck, for instance, Richard Lillestadte, and Albert Einstein among them. For many educated Jews like Haber, conversion was simply a way to remove a stumbling block. In the modern world, advancement would be based not on religion, but on achievements. Heber's God was not the God of Moses, not the God of Peter, but the God of science. Pure rationality offered an escape from the old prejudices, as well as a path to a better material life. Here again, Germany was preeminent. Germany was the best place in the world to do science. German universities had the best professors. German industries had the most advanced facilities. Germans produced the most important discoveries and theories. Germans won the most Nobel Prizes. So science became twinned in Haber's mind with national pride. The two things fused into a single way of life. Germany might be Europe's youngest major nation. It might be land poor, might lack the colonial buildings of other European powers, might be short of natural resources other than iron and coal, might have poor soils and harsh winters, might be trapped between huge Russia to the east and the power of France and England to the west, but it was rich in scientific power. Belief in the nation, in the Kaiser, in the future, in discipline and in science would earn Germany its place in the world. Discipline had built the German army into the best in Europe. Discipline gave its government, under the Iron Chancellor, Otto von Bismarck, its power. Science, too, was disciplined, rigorous in its methods, and certain in its conclusions. Science had turned Germany's meager resources into great wealth, allowing the nation to make the world's best steel from its iron, the world's best machinery from its steel, and the world's best dyes and chemicals from its coal. These industries brought in money from around the world, making Germany rich enough to grow a vibrant, highly educated middle class, including many Jews. As long as Jews contributed to the spirit and accomplishments of science and the nation, Haber thought they would be valued, tolerated, and eventually accepted. Haber buried his Jewishness and threw himself into science. Slowly, too slowly for his ambition, he began to achieve success. He was hired at the University of Karlsruhe, a solid if unspectacular school on the Rhine, south of Heidelberg, joining a chemistry faculty whose members might not be the most renowned in Germany, but were well respected. Haber found that he was good at parties and enjoyed socializing, drinking, and talking about books as well as science. He loosened up a bit and made friends with some of the more liberal members of the faculty and local artists, creating a bit of bohemia in Karlsruhe. As one writer put it, he became known as a reciter of literature and teller of jokes and stories. He began to enjoy Karlsruhe, although the prominence of the school never matched the eminence of his own self-image. Haber tamed his restless intellectual energies, settled down in the laboratory, and built a reputation as a precise experimentalist and an innovative thinker. He did studies on everything from corrosion of pipes under city streets to the laws of thermodynamics, from electrochemistry and the loss of energy in engines to the reactions that lay at the luminous heart of flames. He wrote a successful book on the thermodynamics of gas reactions. He began to earn a solid reputation. In 1906, he achieved what was for any German a highly respected position, university professor, in Haber's case, of physical chemistry and electrochemistry. This meant not only a title of honor, but also a secure salaried position. Haber settled down, married a bright young woman, a Jewish girl from his hometown, the first woman to earn a PhD in chemistry at her university, had a little son, and seemed destined for a long, productive, relatively quiet career. But he wanted more. He always wanted more. He wanted more money, more fame, more respect. He worked too hard, took on too much, and still suffered from nerves. His career was everything to him, and he proved a distant and self-centered husband. His marriage suffered. Fritz is so scattered. If I didn't bring to him, his son, every once in a while. He wouldn't even know that he was a father, his wife wrote. Then came the Bunsen meeting, the unbearable Walther and Ernst, and the unforgivable insult of having his experimental data called highly erroneous. Not even a chemist as eminent as Nernst could be allowed to level such an accusation. Haber could not let it stand. He threw himself back into his research on pneumonia.